the 95th birthday of Sangharakshita next week. Just for logistical reasons, we couldn't arrange it to do it on the actual day, but we're marking it a little bit before normal. So one of the things I've been thinking about with Sangharakshita, it does feel different now he's not with us any longer. His teaching career is over. So he's been with us a very long time, over 50 years, from the founding of Tri Ratna to his death. And he's been able to teach and, in a way, bring new things to light as the movements unfolded and developed. But that teaching career is now over, and we're in a different phase of, in a way, assessing what he's left us, assessing his legacy to us. So tonight I'm going to have, a little bit of a go at exploring that legacy. Kamesiri wants to start the puja bang on 8:30, so I've got a time limit, so I'm just going to kind of plunge in. And it's just an attempt, it's not an attempt to be completely comprehensive. So I'm going to start just by declaring my own personal interest. I am a member of the order that Sangharakshita founded. I consider myself a disciple of his. That's the language that he uses in relationship to the order, that the order is his disciples and the disciples of his disciples. And I'm very happy to use that language. I'm actually going to go a stage further. I consider him to be my master in spiritual terms. I think of him as my master. I have a lineage that sort of makes sense to me, which comes from Amida Buddha, who's the kind of Buddha in Dharmakaya form, then Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, then Shinran, a particular Japanese Pure Land teacher who I derive great inspiration from, and then Sangharakshita, who's the person I've discovered all of those others through. Basically pretty much everything I've learned about the Dharma has come in one way or another from Sangharakshita. So I do feel a very strong personal connection with him, and in a way a great debt of gratitude for what he's given me. But in order to appraise his teaching, and in a way give it something of an appraisal of him, albeit a very brief one, I think it is important to acknowledge that there are difficulties in his legacy. And I want to address those, partly as a practice of the fourth precept. So the fourth precept is the precept of truthfulness, put positively. So in a way, I want to give as round a picture of Sangharakshita as possible. I want to be true to the different aspects of it. And to do that, I'm going to talk about two of the areas that have been problematic in you know, his legacy to us. It's still showing signs saying you need to change the video resolution, is that? No. Okay. So there are two areas that cause issues, in a way, understandably, for many people in relation to Sangharakshita. So I want to talk a bit about them first, and then I want to go on to say some things about his character, and then also give an appraisal of what he's left us in terms of his teaching. So the first issue I want to talk about is probably the most obvious one, which is his sexual activity. So for some people, I'm imagining everybody who's watching this knows that he was sexually active in a period of his life. If you don't, well, you're going to be hearing this for the first time. So I'm just going to start with a few simple facts just to get clear about what we're talking about. So Sangharakshita was a monk for 20 or so years. When he came back to the West in the 60s, he was in his 40s. As far as we're aware, he hadn't had sexual relations before that. Came back to the great time of sexual experimentation. And during the 1970s and early 80s, he had sexual relationships with a reasonable number of his disciples, people that he had ordained. These are all adult men. It's not children. There's no never been any hint of illegality about it. Munisha, who's the safeguarding officer for Tree Ratna, did talk to the police about it. The police didn't express any interest in bringing any criminal charges against him. So we're in this area of influence, a grey area of influence. It's when a therapist has a sexual relationship with their client, or a doctor with their patient, or a teacher with their student, or in this case, a spiritual teacher and their disciple. It's where somebody has influence over the other person, and there is sexual relationship takes place within that. That's the simple facts. There's lots of interpretation of what went on and different views around all of that. So I'm going to say a few things about that. I want to read something that Sangharakshita said. So one of the issues that this brings up is that Sangharakshita is not perfect, not ethically spotless. He himself, I'll just read you what he wrote. This is late in his life. He says, "I would therefore like to express my deep regret for all the occasions on which I have hurt, harmed, or upset fellow Buddhists and ask for their forgiveness." And then there's a clarification of this, where he says, "Sangharakshita has confirmed that his apology extends to anyone that he has harmed in any way at all, including those who were Buddhists at the time, if not now, and their non-Buddhist family and friends. He further wishes to make it clear that his statement was a confession." So Sangharakshita himself acknowledges unskillfulness. He doesn't explicitly name the sexual unskillfulness in that statement. It's a public statement. He's in some ways a sort of a private man. He's not prone to speak about those things publicly in quite that way. But he does acknowledge that he's caused harm to others. So clearly he acknowledges a certain unskillfulness in his own actions. So if we come to Sangharakshita looking for ethical purity or some kind of perfection, when you hear about this, it can be difficult. People can feel let down in some sort of way. So I just want to say a little bit about this area generally, about kind of holding moral ambiguity. This is something I don't think we're very good at in our society generally. So there are a few things that we can slip into here. It's very easy if we've come across Tree Ratna, we come across Sangharakshita's teachings, we've kind of appreciated them, gained benefit from them, to want him to be perfect. And then when you hear that he was sexually active with some of his disciples, you can move to a state where you want to diss him or bring him down or distance yourself from his teachings. Yeah. So there is a whole tendency in our culture, you know, the trial by social media. I mean, this didn't particularly happen in relation to Sangharakshita, but it happens very quickly and easily now. People can be proven guilty on social media. You know, it's like the law in this country is supposed to be you're innocent to prove guilty. It's almost like these days you can be proved guilty on social media. And there's a whole thing about virtue signalling that goes on. There's all these kind of contemporary attitudes. In a way, this all came out just recently with the Black Lives Matter movement and, you know, talk about bringing Churchill's statue down in Whitehall. So Churchill is another of these characters. He's upheld as the great hero in a famous Radio 4 poll. He was voted as the greatest Briton of all time. He's a very ambiguous figure, though, when you start to read more about him. Clearly had very racist views, certainly towards Indians. And there's quite strong evidence that he was involved in decisions that led to the Bengal, or that contributed to the Bengal famine, which led to over a million, maybe more than 2 million people dying during the Second World War. So at the time that he was, in a way, being the great hero, standing up to the Nazi aggression, he was also expressing racist sentiments and involved in decisions that led to the deaths of Indians, large numbers of Indians, or at least contributed to those deaths. So, but the debate on social media is very easy just to say either he's a great hero and he's the upstanding figure of English culture and the English nation, or we should tear his statue down and bring him down. It's difficult for us to hold somebody who has both things in them, has great qualities, very noble qualities, achieves great things, and is also morally ambiguous or just unskillful. So in a way, I think we need to learn to do this a bit more. We need to learn to hold moral ambiguity. I'm going to quote that famous Buddhist teacher, actually a Christian teacher by the name of Jesus. There's the famous story from the Gospel of John, where these people are about to stone a woman for adultery. And Jesus makes this comment. This is the actual words from the Gospel of John. "He that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her." I think this is brilliantly insightful. He says, he of you who is without sin, let them cast the first stone. So basically he's pointing it right back to you. He's taking the moral lens away from someone else and directing it back to you. This is our principal concern as Buddhists. It's not to blame and find fault with others. It's to examine and reflect on our own ethical shortcomings and do our best to limit or even eradicate those. Yeah. So I think it's very important to remember that when we're thinking about other people's shortcomings. It's not about letting them off the hook or denying that they did them. But it's not getting into moral outrage when, maybe ourselves are not so pure as we might like to be. I think that's a very, very insightful thing of statement of Jesus's. So there's also the whole thing about, if we do move to criticising someone else, particularly someone we've idealised them, maybe we've over-idealised them, and then we criticise them and bring them down to below the level of the earth, as it were. It's this sort of polarising that can go on, over-idealisation and a kind of rather quick flip to damnation in some way. In a way, when we do either of those things, what is that doing for us? It's almost like they can kind of let us off the hook. If we over-idealise someone, they're too kind of far, too much perfect, too perfected, we're not going to achieve that. And then if they're damned, then we don't have to listen to the good things that they may have done or the good things that they've taught. So, again, I think in this area we have to look to our own actions and take responsibility for our own actions. And then try and be with this moral ambiguity, where someone has a legacy that includes very, very positive things and also unskillfulness and difficult things. It's a kind of skill of maturing, emotionally and spiritually maturing, to be able to live with and hold those things. I say, I'm not saying that excuses Sangharakshita's actions at all. In a way, we all have to come to our own personal view about the seriousness of his ethical shortcomings. My own view is that he was acting clearly out of self-interest. He was short-sighted about the effects of what he was doing, and there's an element of naivety there. That's my view. In a way, you have to form your own view of what you think is sexual activity, how serious you think it is in terms of an ethical shortcoming. I certainly don't attribute any maliciousness to his motives. But yes, clearly it has caused pain, significant pain, for certainly five or six of those people who had sexual relationships with them. If not at the time, after the event, it's become a source of very significant pain, and that's very regrettable. But yeah, we need to find our own view of that if we're coming into a relationship with Sangharakshita through being a part of the movement that he founded. It's up to you how you weigh that, weigh his unskillfulness. Okay, the other area that I am going to mention, I'm going for the real hot potatoes, is in some circles he is labelled a misogynist. And there are, again, well, there's two sort of aspects to this. So I'm going to start with the facts, as it were. If this is new to you, well, you're going to hear it sometime, and I think it's best that it's out in the open. So he expresses a view about the relative aptitude for spiritual life of men and women. And he considers that women are at something of a disadvantage, largely due to biological conditioning. Now, this is enters into a very controversial area in our day and age. He does base that on Buddhist tradition and also on some of his own experience. But he also clarifies that it's only in the early stages of spiritual life. It's not about potential, this is about relative spiritual aptitude. And there's a second point where he goes on to disagree with the feminist interpretation of history as the systematic oppression of women by men. So he doesn't agree with that as being the primary motive force in history. That one seems to me straightforward. I mean, there are Marxist interpretations of history that give different motive forces. No doubt there is conflict between men and women. Men have no doubt had the upper hand a lot of the time, but it's not the sole motive force in history. That's what he's saying. So again, these are very contentious topics at the moment. These are up for debate. So I'm going to go on to say, he went on to clarify, this has been a big area of discussion and debate within the order. Many people not happy with it. He goes on to clarify something in a paper called What is the Western Buddhist Order? So this is given to order members, talking to order members. Again, I'm just going to read you what he says. So he says, I regard that as a difference of opinion, that does not affect their discipleship. So he's talking about people who are saying they don't agree with what he's saying about this relative spiritual aptitude or difference in spiritual aptitude. So he says it does not affect their discipleship. He's basically saying it is not key. You do not have to agree with him to be a disciple. He's using the language of discipleship. He's talking to an audience of order members. If you're not an order member, you're not a disciple in that way, but you're still maybe in his influence if you're in Tree Ratna. Then he goes on to say, so thus, if someone believed that men and women have perfectly equal spiritual aptitudes, that would not be incompatible with their being my disciple. And he also says it is also worth saying that an order member is not obliged to believe that men and women are exactly equal in their spiritual aptitudes. But he's making the point that if you don't agree with him, in a way, don't let that be a big issue. Just acknowledge a disagreement. Yeah? And he's fine with that. You don't have to accept this view of his. It's not important in the big scale of things. It's not essential to his teaching of the Dharma. So this is one of the things, like I say, people can get quite caught on this, anyway, understandably. But if it is an issue for you, I would follow his advice. I disagree with him. There's plenty of value in the teaching that I'm just going to get on and explore. I'm just going to leave that to one side. You know, if you sort of end up chewing over it, as it were, a lot, you get things out of perspective. So I'd urge you just to let it be. You know, it's not essential to his teaching of the Dharma. But I do want to address it's on the basis of those views that he sometimes called a misogynist. I don't accept that there's any degree of misogyny in Sangharakshita's character or in his actions. He very clearly was capable of having significant friendships with women, deep friendships with women, with a wide range of women. I used to live at Adishtana, and I was in the office where people would come and wait before they went to see Sangharakshita. And I saw women from all around the world, Indian women, American women, Mexican women, Australians and New Zealanders, Europeans, British women, coming to see Sangharakshita. clearly benefiting from their contact with him. And I know many women who actually have close or had close friendships with him over many, many years. So I don't think the label misogynist sticks in terms of his attitudes. There's a book called Dear Dinu, which is a whole account of his letters that he wrote to this Indian woman, Dinu Dubash, just a very, very close friendship that they had over many, many years. So he's clearly very able to have strong, close friendship with women, very sort of metaphor relationships with women. So I don't think, in my own interpretation, the label misogyny doesn't fit with his behaviour. More importantly, he set up an order which women were ordained on exactly the same terms as men. They were ordained by him to start with. But then he set up an ordination process where women ordain women. This is actually pretty radical and revolutionary in the Buddhist world. In a way, if our civilization survives the impending crises facing it, particularly the ecological crisis, if we do survive, I think he's going to be much better known for founding an order in which women are ordained on exactly the same footing as men, and women are ordained by women. This is a radical thing to do. In a way, it implies a very deep trust in women and their spiritual potential, their spiritual abilities. So again, I think his actions very much disprove that label of misogyny, even if the views are still controversial. So those are the two kind of significant areas that can cause problems for people. I don't know if what I've said is of help. I hope it is. If it's not, maybe we can talk some more at some point, or you can talk with people about issues that you might have in relation to that. I'm also going to say a few things about his character, because some people find him difficult to relate to because of his character. In a way, I'm just going to say a couple of things about his character. Sangharakshita was born before the Second World War. He's from a completely different generation to us post-1960s types. Sangharakshita never had psychotherapy or counselling, like most of us have. You know, he doesn't talk about his feelings. He doesn't talk about his emotions in the way that we do. He also grew up at a time, in his sexual inclinations, he was homosexual. He grew up at a time when homosexuality was still legally punishable in this country through chemical castration or imprisonment. You know, so his whole ability to express that side of himself was completely not acceptable until he got back in the 60s and 70s when the law began to change. So he was subject to very, very different social conditioning to us. He got very different emotional makeup. So I think it's important not to want something from him, want him to be something that he's not. He's from a very different kind of culture. My own experience of people from that generation, it corresponds with my experience of Sangharakshita. You know, I lived with someone called Singhajitta, born a year after Sangharakshita. I lived with him for a few years, and very, very lovely man. I got very close to him, but he just didn't, when we reported in, he just didn't talk about his feelings in the way that we all do in our post-60s, post-therapy age. So I think it's important when we come to Sangharakshita, just allow him to be who and what he is, rather than getting into our likes and dislikes and wanting him to be a certain way because we want our teacher to be a certain way, or disliking certain things about him. Just let his character and his personality be what it is. He's also, some people find his writing style difficult. So I want to just say something about that as well. One of the things I love about Sangharakshita is that he never ever talks down to you, either personally when I've met him or in any of his books, any of his lectures. He always kind of educates as he talks. This is one of the things I love about his teaching, and I feel I've received an education, not just in the Dharma, but much more widely from him. He educates and just shares this abundance of knowledge and wisdom that he has. But he doesn't talk down. He doesn't present the Dharma in a dumbed down kind of way, in a nice, feely-touchy way, something that he characterised as candy floss Buddhism. You know, all looks and feels very nice, but when you compact it down, there's very little there. He never, ever does that, not in my experience. I think that's something really wonderful about him, and I absolutely, wholeheartedly rejoice that he never decides to talk down to anyone. Doesn't mean he doesn't find the appropriate tone. You know, when he's in India, he, you know, and teaching amongst illiterate villagers, obviously, you know, he'll teach in a different way. But he never kind of brings the Dharma down. He always raises you up if you allow him to do that. He's also absolutely precise in his use of language. And again, some people find this difficult because you have to resort to a dictionary at times if you're studying Sangharakshita. I've again come to really deeply appreciate his precision with words. When he says something, you can be absolutely sure that he means what he says. He has thought about those words absolutely, and he knows the full meaning and the full weight of those and what they are really going to communicate. So if you take the time to engage with that, you can understand very clearly what he is saying. It's a really wonderful, wonderful quality. So you can go back, you know, like even in those two things that I've read about his confession or apology and then confession, and also his writing about, you know, you can disagree with him on his views about aptitude, spiritual aptitude. The words there, if you go back and read the originals, they're very, very precise, and you will know exactly what he's saying. So I completely rejoice in that. So if it is something that you find tricky, the writing style, I'd urge you to, in a way, put aside likes and dislikes and make the effort. He educates and uplifts as he teaches. This is something that the Buddha does in the Pali Canon. He often leads into a deeper teaching by raising, you get the impression he just raises people's level of consciousness as he's communicating with them. He broadens things out, brings in an aesthetic element, and then communicates the Dharma. I think Sangharakshita does that a lot in his own teaching. It's one of the things I very much appreciate about him. So I've got maybe another 15 minutes. So I want to just say a few things about appraising his teachings generally. So this is, you know, in the light of the fact that he's no longer with us, he's no longer going to be clarifying or elaborating or developing new teachings. But we do have this literally vast body of work that he's left us. Lectures, seminars, books, poetry, some short stories. It's a vast, vast ocean of Dharma. Probably, Vidya Devi, who edits the collected works, it's possible she's read pretty much everything, but otherwise I doubt that anybody has. I certainly haven't read everything. I've studied his work over 35 years and I know it pretty well, but there's certainly things I haven't read. So I'm going to give three categories of things, and then I want to give some potential criteria for how we might assess his teachings. So I think that there are some things in his teaching that we can, a bit like he says himself in relation to his views about spiritual aptitude of men and women, that we don't have to accept as essential or integral to his teaching. I'm just going to give one example, and it relates back to that topic in some way. In his lecture series on the Bodhisattva ideal, he uses the language of masculinity and femininity to describe the paramitas, the perfections, these great practices of the Bodhisattva. He relates masculinity to virya and femininity to kshanti. Now, this is a non-traditional teaching. I don't know anyone else who's made those connections in that way. There is symbolism in the Buddhist tradition of the male and female Buddhas and the Abhyam figures, which explores integration of masculine and feminine characteristics, you could say. But as far as I'm aware, connecting those with virya and kshanti is something that only Sangharakshita has done. My own reading of that is that he gave those lectures in 1969. I know that in the 60s and 70s he was reading a lot of psychology, a lot of Carl Jung particularly. You can get this in other of his lectures. You'll pick up quite a few references to Carl Jung. And Carl Jung was in the air of those times. You know, he was seen as one of the people who exemplified a kind of a spiritual life in a very materialistic age. So I think Sangharakshita is exploring, he's trying to make a connection of traditional teachings with ideas of the time, masculinity and femininity, the whole idea that the man has an unrealised feminine aspect to themselves that they project out in falling on love, and likewise the woman does the same. This whole notion of we're not integrated in our own being, in the anima or the animus in Jungian terms. So he's trying to make a connection with that and teaching that and saying we need to resolve those opposites, integrate those opposites as a way to give rise to the bodhicitta. Now that may not really be relevant any longer. It may not. I don't think it works especially well to connect those terms with virya and kshanti. In a way, I think you could just explore virya and kshanti without having to bring those terms in. Sometimes those terms can get in the way. But it's also like he was taking a teaching and making it relevant to the atmosphere and the ideas around at the time. Jung is still an important figure, but psychology's moved on a lot. We've had James Hillman since then. We've had Myers-Briggs, which is a development of Jungian ideas. I mean, we've had the whole development of neuroscience and things like that. So in a way, maybe nowadays we would need to be making connections with those rather than with the language of masculinity and femininity that I think comes from Carl Jung, and that's probably where he got that influence. So I don't think that's essential to his teaching. It's terms that he's using to try and make a connection with a traditional teaching. It's not essential. Stick with virya and kshanti and explore those. If masculinity and femininity are not helpful in that way, again, I don't think that they're essential. That's just an example. But then there are essential aspects of his teaching that I don't think we are in a position to drop or change. I mean, these ones will be fairly obvious, and I haven't really got time to explore them in any depth. But the things like the centrality of going for refuge, I mean, it's very easy, it gets talked about a lot in our movement, so it's easy to take it for granted. But if you trace the way he arrived at understanding the spiritual life in terms of going for refuge, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, it's actually a very, very profound thing that he is saying. And I think the implications of it have still not been fully worked out, to be honest. There's his emphasis on the importance of art and beauty in the spiritual life. It's a distinctive aspect of his own teaching, but if you read his Religion of Art and the Meaning of Buddhism and the Value of Art, you'll see it's very closely connected to the teaching of the Buddha as well. He gives very specific roots into the Buddhist tradition as a whole. In a way, there's also his whole understanding and creation of a meaningful and effective Sangha in the modern world. Brilliant insight into seeing beyond the division in the East between the monks and the laity to something much more primary than that. And this Sangha is alive both in India and in, you know, Western conditions. It's a brilliant thing he's done in creating the Sangha that he has. That's not something that is kind of optional or that we can choose to move on from. There's also his whole ability to see the Dharma as a whole. Again, I don't know any Dharma teacher, any contemporary Dharma teacher, who knows the Dharma in the range and depth that Sangharakshita does. I think there are contemporary teachers who know their own part of Buddhist tradition very deeply and very well. I don't know of any other contemporary Buddhist teacher that gets the range and breadth and sees the unity and depth of the Buddhist tradition in the way that Sangharakshita does. It's a profound insight that he has into the unity of the Dharma. That's not, again, something to be dismissed or left as being, you know, specific to the times in which he taught. He's also given us plenty of teachings that need to be developed much further. Again, I'm just going to name them briefly, really. These are three that just came to my mind. There may well be more. You know, in the Buddhist tradition, we have termas, or in the Tibetan tradition, you have termas, these hidden texts or hidden teachings of Pema Samgha that are found by later generations. Some of these we need to work out as later generations. We need to develop these teachings. So his teaching on the five niyamas as an integrative schema that includes the whole of existence, basically, including the scientific, the psychological, the volitional, and the truly dharmic and transcendental. It's a brilliant, brilliant schema that he's laid out for us, but it's very much just the bare bones of that schema. We've got to work out the implications of all of that. But it is, the more I've thought about that teaching, the more brilliant I think it is that he's taken these terms from early tradition and given them this new and distinctive kind of meaning. It's also his whole teaching on the imaginal faculty. Ties in a little bit with his emphasis on art and beauty, but he's basically suggested that the faculty by which we come to know reality is this, what he calls the imaginal faculty. He's trying to, if I understand him rightly, he's trying to avoid an overly conceptual approach to the Dharma by saying that we have this higher faculty which in a way integrates and transcends both reasoning and emotion, feeling. Again, very, very profound teaching that I think still needs to be absorbed and worked out in much, much greater detail. It's up to us as his still living followers, disciples if we're in the order, or followers, to take that teaching and make it better known and work out its implications. And then he also, just in a little essay that he wrote in the last year or so of his life, he talked about a fourth lakshana. So we usually talk about three lakshanas, three marks of conditioned existence. So dukkha, anicca, impermanence, and no self or no fixed self. He suggested that there's a fourth lakshana and a fourth doorway to liberation associated with it, which is the lakshana of shubha, or beauty, or ashubha, relative ugliness, and spiritual beauty. Again, this has very profound significance for a whole approach to the Dharma, to be able to see the Dharma in terms of beauty, cultivation, appreciation, development of beauty. That is a new and developmental teaching within the Buddhist tradition. So these are just some of the riches that he's left for us. There's much, much, much to be explored. I was going to suggest some criteria about how we might assess those teachings, but actually, I'm not going to go there. I'm just going to finish with one or two personal stories. Just by way of evoking, we're going to be doing a puja in his honour, in his memory. Shortly, Kama Siri is going to introduce some of his poetry in that. But I'll just share a couple of stories, just by way of evoking him as a man. Obviously, if you never met him, you never will now. So there's something about keeping that sense of him as a man alive in some way. So yes, I'll say one thing. I did quite a bit of work on the first version of the Dharma training course for Mitras. I sort of oversaw the development of it in 2007-8-9. And as part of that, I went to meet him a couple of times to talk through some things in relation to that. And one of the things I had to ask him was about his whole teaching on the higher evolution. Again, this is a language that he developed in the 60s and 70s. There was quite a bit of talk amongst the Mitra conveners about dropping this, thinking it was no longer relevant. And I went along with this view that he'd just used the language of evolution as a skillful means to try and get it across to a modern Western scientific mindset. And I sort of put this to him. And he just looked back at me and he said, no, that's how I experience it. And it was like a depth charge going off. I was coming in with this quite kind of rational approach to things. He just says, I took him to mean that he just experiences life in terms of this evolutionary impulse, and particularly this higher evolutionary impulse. That's his actual experience. That's what he seemed to be saying to me. So there's sometimes when you were with Sangha, actually, sometimes he just felt very ordinary. And times like that, it's a bit like the bottom just drops out of the conversation and you're sitting with, it felt like I was sitting with somebody of very great depth and profundity, and his experience of the world was just much, much, much deeper than mine. It's quite an experience to have. I'll also just say one other story and then I'm going to finish, which is again around that time he came and led study on Mitch Convener's meetings that I was attending, and one of the times he was having lunch with us and I sat next to him at the lunch table. This is after his eyesight had started to deteriorate, he had macular degeneration, so he never quite knew whether he could really see you or not. I sat next to him thinking he probably can't see who I am and probably wouldn't even remember me even if he did. You know, I'd only met him a few times at that point. And we sat and ate in silence as he usually does. And then afterwards he just turned to me and he said to me, are you still in contact with that Christian Orthodox priest in Bath that you mentioned to me? So basically he remembered a detail about my life from a letter that I'd written to him probably a year or two beforehand. And he had this kind of awareness of me as an individual remembering some significant thing that had been going on in my life as I've been exploring a bit of dialogue with this Christian Orthodox priest. And it kind of just confounded this idea that I had that I wasn't significant to him. So I think one of the things that Sangha Rakshita had was a real gift for friendship. He could really take people in. I felt really taken in by him. And on that occasion and subsequent ones, you know, so he could remember a detail. If you think back to that letters that you received a couple of years ago and then suddenly you're sitting down at a table and you can't quite see someone, he knew me and he knew a significant detail and he was able to, you know, bring that into the conversation. I felt very strongly kind of met as a, you know, as an individual person that he was interested in and was, you know, and cared for in some way. Anyway, I'm going to leave it there. Henry Bartin's got to do a quick couple of things to finish, and then we're going to start a puja at 8:30. But I hope that's been of help. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much, Sachinanda, for that full-blooded talk.